from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 35 American soldiers, some in critical condition, are at the U.S. military hospital in Landstuhl, Germany tonight after being wounded in Tuesday's massive apparent suicide bombing at a U.S. base in Mosul. Colonel Rhoda Cornum, head of the Landstuhl Medical Center, said today that the wounded all had a reasonable chance of surviving. Their bodies may heal, but what about the psychological trauma, the mental impact of seeing a suicide bomber blow up a lunch tent full of fellow soldiers, or of the daily threat of sudden death on the roads of Iraq, or of patrolling neighborhoods where any passerby could be the enemy? Many experts are now calling psychological trauma the hidden toll of the Iraq War. According to Pentagon figures, some experts predict that more than 100,000 U.S. soldiers coming out of Iraq may need mental health treatment in the coming years. Tonight on Point, American troops under fire and the psychological wounds of the Iraq War. Joining me now is Scott Shane, reporter for the New York Times. He's been covering the story of U.S. soldiers' mental health trauma and treatment in the Iraq War. He joins us from Baltimore. Scott Shane, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So what's your finding from your reporting, Scott? How well prepared is the U.S. Military medical system and veteran medical system to handle what may be a wave of mental health needs coming back from Iraq?
Well, I guess on the one hand, you could say that they're much better prepared than they were during the Vietnam era. In fact, the whole concept of post-traumatic stress disorder, this sort of collection of symptoms that comes from prolonged exposure to an extremely stressful environment like the combat environment in Iraq, was created as a result of the study of Vietnam veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And Iraq is the first time that this many U.S. troops have been involved in sustained close quarters combat since Vietnam.
Mm.
And also, even those who are not involved in the sort of Fallujah-style hand-to-hand, house-to-house combat, even the truck drivers in Iraq are at grave risk of running over an explosive and dying or being injured severely in that way, so that the entire theater is an extremely stressful environment. The military and the Veterans Administration, or the Department of Veterans Affairs, as it's now called, both are geared up much better than they were 30 years ago to recognize these kinds of problems, to try to prevent them and to treat them. But the numbers are really potentially quite large. And if you talk to psychiatrists and psychologists and other mental health professionals in the VA system in particular, which will end up getting a lot of these folks, they say that they're operating close to capacity now. So there is some question as to whether they'll be able to handle the caseload that is expected.
Scott, with the holidays on us, we're especially mindful right now of the sacrifice of U.S. soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, for that matter. What's the state of care for them in the field as they deal with this, what must be just incredible tension every day? Bombs could go off anywhere, anytime, and now the notion that they're erstwhile Iraqi allies themselves, or at least people in Iraqi military uniforms, could be suicide bombers. How are these issues being addressed in Iraq before soldiers come home?
Well, they are trying to, the military is trying to bring the treatment to the front to some degree. The Army has deployed something called combat stress control teams, which consist of psychiatrists, psychologists, other mental health professionals who are deployed with units in Iraq, and the theory that they're operating on is that if you see the soldiers suffering from the effects of acute combat stress, sort of overwhelmed by what they're experiencing, that in the past there was sort of a stark choice between leaving them there or evacuating them, which carried a certain amount of stigma and isolation. You were pulled away from your comrades. You know, the talk was, oh, so-and-so went crazy.
The idea they couldn't hack it.
Couldn't hack it. You couldn't make it. And so Now they try to pull them out of the, you know, the immediate combat environment, but leave them close to their unit and give them short-term treatment in the field if it's not too severe. And, you know, the top psychiatrist for the military told me that they find that just a rest, a clean uniform, a shower, some food, those kinds of things can actually have a surprisingly beneficial effect. But the part of what's insidious about these problems is that they often don't arise in the field. The body is wired, is flooded with adrenaline
mm-hmm.
when the soldier is out on the streets, you know, looking at Iraqis passing by, wondering, you know, is one of these guys an insurgent?
Yep.
And that is a very obviously to be flooded with adrenaline in that situation is functional. It allows you to react very quickly. They find when they come back home after months in this state that they can't turn it off. That they have what doctors call exaggerated startle reflex.
Meaning a loud noise might send them off, you know, just to the floor
Hypervigilance, mm-hmm. they also call it. So that, you know, a fellow I interviewed who's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder after returning from Iraq said that recently he went to a bank at lunch hour, and it was just a sort of lunch hour crowd in a bank office, and he found himself eyeing all the people with sort of suspicion, like, you know.
Mm-hmm. One by one, checking them out.
Threat, and beginning to feel, you know, sort of tension and anxiety, that feeling like he had to get out of there, that there was some kind of threat there. And that comes from not being able to switch off these reactions when you get home. And it can cause severe stresses on family relationships, as well. Often marriages break up. Often people drink heavily when they come back. And sometimes this doesn't even happen for several months after the person's back. And so it's not necessarily something you can solve at the front.
Scott, let me ask you, we saw last summer a U.S. Army supported study, I guess it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, that said something like 17% of troops in Iraq, one in five nearly, suffered mental health problems. Now, you're reporting people saying that maybe 100,000 troops may need mental health treatment when they get back to the States. How are people coming up with this number?
Well, that's just a ballpark estimate. The military is hoping that all the steps it's taking will reduce the toll. But some of that is based on Vietnam. In Vietnam, years after the Vietnam War, there were a couple of fairly thorough studies of Vietnam veterans, and they found that at any given time, and this is well after the war again, 15% of Vietnam veterans were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, and that the lifetime prevalence, the people who had suffered it at some point after their Vietnam experience, was all the way up to 30%. So I was amazed to find in researching that story that the number of American servicemen and women who have served in either the conflict in Iraq or the conflict in Afghanistan is approximately 1 million now. It's about 950,000
wow.
at the end of September, and there's been some turnover since then. So it's about 1 million people who served over there. So even at the even if you knock out a couple hundred thousand of those for people who were perhaps serving on ships in the Persian Gulf
mm-hmm.
or in some less stressful environment,
right?
And even if you take a sort of low end estimate of the one in six, which, as you say, the Army study found, again, those are folks being studied in the region,
mm-hmm.
so those who might develop these symptoms later on were not counted. But if you run that sort of one by six times, even 600,000, you're already 100,000. So that's where those numbers come from. And of course, the war isn't over, and as we saw in the last couple of days, shows no sign of being over for American troops anytime soon.
You quote a high-placed former Defense Department official saying that there's a very strong sense that the mental health consequences are going to be the medical story of this war. Scott Shane, thanks for your reporting, and thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Scott Shane of the New York Times, he spoke with me from Baltimore. We're talking tonight about U.S. soldiers and the psychological toll of the Iraq War. Can you imagine the mental impact of being in a place where lunch tents go up in flames, where Humvees explode, where it's almost impossible to tell friend from foe? American soldiers, American families, what have you seen? How can we best support troops facing the trauma of this war? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Alexandria, Virginia, is Stephen Robinson, Executive Director of the National Gulf War Resource Center. He's a 20-year Army veteran who served in the Special Forces in the first Gulf War. He's author of Hidden Toll of the War in Iraq, Mental Health in the Military, a report out on the mental health needs of troops in Iraq. Stephen Robinson, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beeney, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Stephen Robinson, you know what it is to be in the military. You were in the Gulf War. You're looking at what's going on right now. You've pulled together a lot of research for this big report. How significant a problem do you see mental health issues coming out of the Iraq War?
It's a big problem. Scott touched on the fact that the strategy now is to try to keep people in Iraq. And one of the things I think we need to discuss tonight is the difference between that kind of care, keeping someone near the stressor that has created their problem in the first place, mm-hmm. or evacuating them. And while it may create a certain amount of stigma to be removed if you're combat ineffective, I think it creates a significant danger to keep someone around the environmental stressor that created their problem in the first place.
Stephen Robinson, let me ask you, are people being kept close to the front because it's believed that they can actually, manage the mental health issues in that environment better, or simply because they're needed in this war effort where we've clearly been strapped for troops?
I believe it's the latter. I believe it's that they're needed. It's also the idea that it keeping them close to their unit allows some form of reducing the stigma. But the kind of treatment that they get is basically 72 hours of rest and recuperation. There is no real safe place, as demonstrated yesterday, to go to be totally away from the combat environment. And so these soldiers will get some rest. They'll get a warm meal. They'll get medications, in some cases very strong psychotropic drugs. But they don't get the therapy that addresses the reason why they became combat ineffective. They basically just get to rest.
And is it possible to get that therapy in the field, or are you saying they need to simply come home or come out of the theater?
Well, it's difficult for the military because almost everyone will be affected in one way or another to the kinds of things that are happening in Iraq. It's a very vicious the enemy surrounds you 360 degrees. You're hypervigilant constantly.
Mm-hmm.
But there has to be some kind of cutoff line where you either evacuate the people back to Germany for treatment and care and then back to Iraq. But I'm a little curious about the idea of keeping them in Iraq. Picture firefighters from 9/11 days after the attacks. Being forced to go back into buildings and climb stairs and do their job
and relive all that.
Yeah, so these soldiers do relive it. They don't get the opportunity. So there has to be kind of a line drawn: who is too ill or too sick to continue to fight, and if they are, evacuate them to a real safe place.
Jack Beeney, I want to get you in before the break. A tough call here. I mean, war is hell, and it's not. That's not just a saying. Even for people who don't show any measurable mental health problems, tough to judge when to take people out and when to leave them there, especially when there's such pressure to have troop levels up.
Well, there you are, especially when there's such pressure. Doesn't this take us back again to the undermanning of this entire venture? I mean, we're at least 100,000 troops short for the job, according to General Shinseki from several years ago. And what does that mean? It means that you've got to put young men and women into this more intense experience of harm to make up for your lack of strategic judgment in putting the right number of troops there in the first place.
And the price is there to be paid. Jack, Steve Robinson, please stand by. We're talking tonight about American troops under fire and the mental health consequences of the war in Iraq. Is talking about this the first step in embracing these soldiers, whatever wounds they bring home? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American troops under fire and the mental health consequences of the war in Iraq, the psychiatric casualties, inevitably, of a war. You can join the conversation tonight. Is the country ready for the projected tens of thousands of soldiers likely to return from Iraq with serious, if treatable, mental health problems? And is talking about it, we ask again, is that the first step in embracing these soldiers, whatever wounds they bring home? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty, also by Stephen Robinson, a 20-year Army veteran. He's executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center. And right now, from Seattle, Washington, by Dr. Evan Cantor. He's staff psychiatrist at the Puget Sound Veterans Hospital. He's also Northwest Regional Director of Physicians for Social Responsibility. Dr. Evan Cantor, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
So you're there in the Veterans Hospital in Puget Sound. Are you already seeing troops coming back from Iraq with mental health issues?
Absolutely. Iraq and Afghanistan as well.
And what's the profile? What is doing? I don't know if it's possible to say. Is it the same kind of thing you see from any war? Is there something special going on here? How do you read it?
It's absolutely the same kind of thing that you see in any war. We hear a lot about Vietnam in our culture, but I see veterans with these problems from the first Gulf War, from Somalia, Bosnia, Central America, World War II, Korea, you name it. Many places that you haven't heard of, and it's always the same.
Dr. Cantor, take us into this just for a moment. We want to hear what's coming back, what the issues are right now. But when did psychiatry and the military first become really aware of post-traumatic stress dynamic that we're seeing here? How have we come to understand this?
Well, Scott Shane is very thorough in his knowledge, and he was absolutely accurate. The knowledge has surfaced periodically over the centuries, really, and it's been in the Civil War. It was soldier's heart. In World War One, it was shell shock. World War Two, it was combat neurosis, and basically, the society was not able to handle it. And swept it under the rug.
Because it didn't appear gallant and valiant enough.
That's part of it. But I think it's just, I don't think the medical community was capable of handling it at that time.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And really, the reason that we have it, post-traumatic stress disorder entered the medical books in 1980. And largely as a result of the Vietnam veterans and the political and moral force of their movement. They sat around in these rap groups and looked at each other and basically said, hey, you know, you're having the same symptoms as I am. Something's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually drugged the doctors along with them and said, you can't sweep this under the rug anymore. We need to get this out in the open. And since then, since 1980, we've been able to study the condition and do research and come up with some useful treatments.
Can you explain the mechanics of PTSD? I mean, how does it work? These adrenaline rushes come at the battlefront combined with the images and the things that people see. What happens to the body that leaves this kind of psychological scarring, if that's the way to look at it?
It is. PTSD, it needs to be viewed as a chronic illness, just like you would diabetes or heart disease.
But what creates it exactly? Is it a hormone surge that does something with the hard wiring?
The mechanism is unclear, but what we do know is when people are exposed to these overwhelming traumas where their brain is awash with adrenaline, you get a change in the brain chemistry and the way that the brain functions. We can see some of these changes even on a brain scan at this point.
Mm.
And basically, there's a part of the brain called the amygdala It's the emotional brain. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's called the reptile or dinosaur brain. Mm-hmm. It's responsible for fear and anger, strong emotions. And that part of the brain is hyperactive. It gets triggered off very easily, and then it has a hard time coming back down again.
And as a result of these experiences in war.
Right. Mm-hmm. And why some people get PTSD and some people don't is a really important question. There are a lot of factors involved, but in the final analysis, you never can say exactly why one person got it and one person didn't.
So when you get soldiers coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan and they're struggling with symptoms of PTSD, how do you treat them? What's the therapy?
Well, there are a number of psychotherapies that are somewhat effective. A lot of the main one involve exposure therapy or cognitive therapy.
Meaning exposure therapy, meaning what?
Meaning essentially desensitization. Not everybody can handle that intensity of treatment, but for some people that can, for example, being in a group session with other veterans and going through in detail their traumatic experiences.
So kind of talk therapy to get it out there.
Absolutely, yeah.
And we're seeing now numbers that something like 85% of those in Marine and Army combat units in Iraq, even at the summer before things got even hotter, already knew someone who'd been injured or killed personally. More than half saying they've handled corpses or human remains. So a very high percentage of combat troops really in the thick of it.
And that the single most important factor in whether you get PTSD is just the level of trauma exposure. You know, in medicine, you talk about a dose response effect. And the level of trauma that we're seeing is really extreme. And those figures that you're talking about were actually the early part of the war, the long push in to Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
We're expecting it's going to be a lot worse for the more recent Fallujah-type fighting. Another statistic that's important is that among the 800 Marines in that study, 65% reported that they were responsible for killing an enemy, and 28% were responsible for killing a civilian non-combatant. And that sort of thing, civilian casualties, really is the kind of thing that can make PTSD more likely or make it worse. Also, a big thing that people talk about frequently that you mentioned before is not knowing who the enemy is. That was a huge thing in Vietnam, and it's a huge thing again in Iraq.
And on many fronts now. Evan Kantor, Stephen Robinson, Jack Standby. I want to welcome into our conversation tonight Robert Brown. He joins us from Peru, Indiana. He's a member of the U.S. Marine Corps and was in the first wave of Marines that invaded Iraq last year. He served in Iraq for 6 months. Robert Brown, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Good evening. How are you?
We're real well, and we're grateful to you for coming on. Because you are no stranger to what we're talking about tonight.
No, sir, I'm not. Just to make clarification, I was United States Navy. I was a religious program specialist assigned to the 2nd Marine Expeditionary Brigade. There's three job ratings in the United States Navy, and we actually get assigned to the Marine Corps, and then we actually go through Marine training to serve with the Marines.
Got it.
Paid by the Navy, but I was Marine Corps, if that makes any sense.
I get it, and thanks for that clarification.
Okay.
Tell us about your time there and the mental health issues that it's left you with.
Today it's much better. I've had some really great help from the VA. I was fortunate to be on the first waves coming back. I went over January 12, 2003, from Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, deployed with the 2nd Marine Expeditionary Brigade, Task Force Tarawa. My chaplain, Commander Hightower, worked directly for General Natansky.
And you were a Marine chaplain's assistant, was your capacity?
No, there's a difference there. That's where I need a little clarification.
Okay.
The Army has chaplain assistants, mm-hmm. which actually they can fill the role of a chaplain.
Mm-hmm.
My sole duty is to assist the chaplain.
Right, okay.
In garrison.
Mm-hmm.
Front lines is, in the Geneva Convention, the chaplain is the only 100% non-combatant in war.
So as an assistant to the chaplain, you could also be a combatant?
I am the only combatant in that capacity.
Mm-hmm.
The Geneva Convention states that if a chaplain shows any act of aggression, then they have to resign their commission.
So what was it, Robert Brown, that in your service there got to you?
That's still what I'm still trying to work out today. I'm 35 years old. I enlisted in the military at 17. I started with the Indiana Guard as infantry and progressed through to Naval Special Forces on active duty in the first Gulf War.
So you know the military environment well.
Very well. I've served in all branches but the Air Force and Coast Guard. So I've trained with the best and know it all. And you get ready for this situation. And the only thing that I can say is the unexpected happens in the time of war, mentally, psychologically, emotionally. For me, seeing these young Marines and sailors, the hardest part I would have to say is seeing them trying to take their own life to avoid the battle.
Did you witness that in Iraq?
Yes, sir, I did.
More than once?
Yes.
Because what do you think drove them to that?
It's only skepticism at this point. I really can't say. Each person goes into the military with their own family situations, and you deal with deployments and all the best you can, being away from family. And the Marine Corps is deployed a lot. My personal family, out of 4 years serving with the Marines, I was actually at home 8 months.
Wow.
So with that, there's a lot of things that happen. So each person's different. So I can't speak for any one person except for the stress level. And then you get into this environment, and then you maybe begin to question yourself or the purpose. I really can't answer that. Why? I don't know.
And you saw plenty of tough scenes yourself in your capacity there, Robert Brown.
In the first 72 hours, I helped coordinate and perform memorial services for 39 of my Marines.
Mm.
We were the first into combat, and me and the chaplain, by the general's decision, asked us to stay behind and come forward as things got heavy. And in that first 48 hours, there was young Marines coming back that had been ambushed in a Nazariah, the bridge ambush, and there was a lot of skepticism there. Some of that may have been friendly fire. There was another ambush on down the road from that, but I flew into a Nazariah in the dump. They called it the city dump for 14 days, and then progressed from there.
And in your capacity, you had to deal with those casualties. That was your job, to acknowledge them.
My job was to ignore the pain and the fear, and to try to provide moral support and religious support to those that needed it. I had 7,500 Marines and sailors from the East Coast, and as a senior enlisted position for that program, it was my responsibility to make sure their needs were met, whatever they may be.
And Stephen Robinson also spoke about the trauma of having to deal with civilian casualties, even at the same time your own fellow soldiers are taking casualties.
Yes,
did you have to deal with that?
There was a couple different incidences. One, I had to preclude myself of being in the religious program specialist position and minister any spiritual needs. One, because we were in a local environment in Al-Kut, and there was a young girl about 3 years old, and there was a celebration, wedding celebration, and they celebrate by shooting their weapons into the air, and the AK-47 round came down and struck her. And our first class petty officer, Thomas, with the 2nd Marine Expeditionary Brigade, provided first aid and saved her life on the spot. There was a couple different incidences like that, but I was on a security patrol. I wasn't in the capacity of providing security for the chaplain because we were undermanned at that time. We were spread out. The 1st Marine Division had then moved into Baghdad, and we were trailing them, cleaning up what they didn't touch. And if anyone followed the war, them and the Army blasted through straight to Baghdad. And as they went through, the Iraqis shedded their uniforms and went into civilian clothes. So
a lot of tough scenes, including, as I understand, prisoners of Saddam's prisons that you saw coming out in just terrible condition. When you came home, Robert Brown, how did you know that there was a problem?
The first problems were probably indicated on board the ship yet when I was trying to counsel some of the other RPs, which is short for religious program specialists that work for the chaplains, that actually were frontline with the infantry, Marine Corps infantry. And this young young sailor had to bury a civilian because the Muslim religion, they bury him before sundown. And he had witnessed this civilian lady set on fire by Iraqis in front of him and had to help extinguish the body and then to... My direct contact is about 30% of my problem, but I did 80% of the pre-counseling before they came to the chaplain.
You heard all these stories, and they weighed on you. What happened when you came home? What were the symptoms of that trauma?
Wow. On board the ship about 21 days in transit coming back, we provided security for the President of the United States in Jordan when they had the summit meeting. I don't know if you all remember, there was one ship coming back from Iraq that stopped to provide security. That was us. And then we also stopped in Africa, off the Horn of Africa, because there was that flare-up at the same time.
And were you feeling unnerved during that journey?
Up till the point we left the offshore of Africa, when the other six ships had been stopping for liberty and we'd been hearing about it, here we are just trying to get home, and we're still fighting a war all the way across the Mediterranean. Something happened about a week and a half later that I'm still trying to understand, and my doctors are helping me pull this stuff out. I couldn't sleep. My anxiety became unbearable. Somebody that used to be in the circus, I grew up roller skating, a lot of acrobatic things, swimming. I'm scared of heights.
Your marriage fell apart. You began drinking.
I became very abusive. Now, I had drank prior to going over, but I had quit for quite a while. And when I came back, I found that to mask dealing with feelings or emotions. And I became very abusive, negligent in my duties, which I had never done in 14 years. I was outstanding, impeccable military record.
Robert Brown, we appreciate that military service, and we're glad to hear from you tonight that you feel like you're beginning to turn a corner on it. We wish you all the best with that, and please feel all of our support.
One quick note.
Yes,
any
sir.
Veteran coming back, get with the VA, and the doctors will help you. Don't put it off. Don't put it off, because you got to start today.
Robert Brown was with the U.S. Navy and the Marines in Iraq. Thanks very much for joining us tonight, Mr. Brown.
God bless and happy holidays.
Same to you. We're talking tonight about American troops under fire and the mental health consequences of the war in Iraq. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American troops under fire and the mental health consequences of the war in Iraq, the psychiatric casualties of a war. You can join the conversation tonight. Is the country more ready in this war than in Vietnam or the World Wars to acknowledge and work with vets with psychic wounds? And are you thinking about American troops who will be at their post in Iraq on Christmas Eve and carrying Iraq inside for a long time? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty is with us tonight. So is Dr. Evan Cantor, staff psychiatrist at the Puget Sound Veterans Hospital, and Stephen Robinson, a 20-year Army veteran, veteran of the Gulf War Special Forces, now executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center. Right now, Frank is calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? I want to thank you guys for bringing this topic up. This is of huge importance. I just got back about a month ago. I'm an Army lieutenant in the medical services, and prior to that, I was enlisted and worked in psychiatry. And I'm coming back with I've got 30 guys underneath me, and we just got back from running all over the place, stationed at Fort Lewis, but we were all over Iraq. And what the main problem in my mind right now is there's nothing set up. There's no screening set up. There's nothing that, at least from the Army's perspective, that's happening for to identify these guys and the problems that they have prior to coming back or as they come back. Historically, I think we're much better off. There's still a huge stigma. Most of the guys, these infantry guys, are coming back. No, I don't need to talk about my problems. But they're going from living in this environment where they have to look over their shoulders every day to nothing. I mean, there's no excitement. So they go out and they buy, you know, a $10,000 motorcycle and they wreck it, or they come home and they drink for 4 days. My issue is, and from the bottom level, being a lieutenant, you know, I'm trying to get whoever can hear this, whoever can, as high up as this can go, and because it's got to start at the top.
What's the message, Frank? What's the message?
Message is for the guys at the top, the guys at the Pentagon, the guys that are better developing the programs, come up with something, come up with a screening program, get these guys integrated back into their environment, into their lifestyle, so that they don't have to resort to, you know, these self-destructive behaviors.
So I want to understand. You're saying you were there, you were doing, your job was psychiatry in the field.
No, that was a prior job.
I see.
Job as an officer, I am a platoon leader of 30 medics, and then the other half of the job is I do operations for a battalion. So I set up medical care for the battalion.
Okay, so you're right in the medical care, and you feel like you've just come back with 30 guys, and you don't feel that the screening was right for them or anybody else in the field or before they came back home to know if they're carrying problems.
Absolutely not. And I mean, the guys that are doing it, mostly it's the chaplain, and through that side of the house, we watched a 30-minute video on pretty much don't come home and beat your wife. And that was about what we got for transitioning back into the state.
And how did that stack up against the trauma that you had seen troops go through in the field? How close to sufficient was that, given what they'd seen and been through?
Well, and my guys, you know, I've got four or five of them with Purple Hearts. One of them's got a couple of them. They see this stuff every day. And to not know where it's coming from next, to not know, you know, I mean, it's all around you. There's no front there. To come home and come back into a society where, all right, now I have to relax. And most of these guys, you know, they're young. They're 18 to 24 years old. And if they have a little bit of education, then they're one step ahead of their buddy. But most of them are naive to the fact that, wow, I've got a lot of stuff on my shoulders, and I don't know how to deal with it.
Frank, how high was the stress that you saw in Iraq? I mean, is it just off the charts every day, or is it up and down?
It depends on where you are. Personally, my job stress for loss of life was minimal. It was about a 5 out of 10. But for my medics who I sent out to with these infantry platoons onto the line, yeah, it was really high. It was up there. These guys were getting shot every day. I've got a soldier who is in patient psychiatry right now, just diagnosed bipolar disorder from, you know, and I know that's a genetic disorder, but it's brought on by the stresses, and I'm sure brought on by the stresses of what he saw. So, and then, you know, I've got another soldier. There's cases of other soldiers in my battalion that are going out, and there's domestic abuse cases back and forth. And I've talked to the courts on this since I've been home, because you've got soldiers in the court system for these cases. They want to slam them. The civilian courts want to slam them because they're so overflooded. They want to send a message, and the only way they know how to do it is to slam the soldier to make a point that, hey, you guys are coming home with nothing, with no way to integrate these guys back into normal society.
So give them a hard knock up the side of the head as treatment.
Right, which doesn't work anyway. You cut it. I mean, they're going to get by the military anyway, and they've already done what they've done, and they're living with that. But these guys are coming home heroes. Everybody that went over there is a hero, and we've got great counseling set up.
Frank, we're losing you, but we appreciate your service and your candor here tonight, and we get the message, and we pass it on. There needs to be screening for the troops coming home so they're not left hanging out to dry. Let's get another caller here. Sam is calling from Boston. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thanks. I want to thank the doctor from Seattle for mentioning the psychological stress of killing in addition to the psychological stress of being at risk of being killed.
Yes.
Because I think this isn't vastly underrated in terms of its psychological impact. And Lieutenant Colonel Grossman has written about this. The Fort Wayne, Indiana Vet Center has been working with veterans who are suffering from post-traumatic stress on this. But in the media and the military still hasn't gotten the message of needing to work with soldiers on the ethical and moral trauma
Sam, we've got it, and it's important. Let us pick it straight up. Dr. Kander, in Seattle, I mean, this is a built-in problem. The military is supposed to kill. That's part of its job, and yet there's trauma that comes with that. How often is that the path to mental health issues, and how do you deal with it?
These are the kind of traumas that can be just completely devastating. Sometimes these are the kind of things that people can even repress. They're so horrible that they won't even remember it for quite a long time. There has not been a lot of attention directed toward the psychological impact of killing specifically. You think there would have been, but there hasn't. Colonel Grossman has written a book called On Killing. That's the best thing that I'm aware of in terms of somebody looking at this problem, but we actually don't know a lot about it.
What portion of the vets that you're treating when they come home are citing that as their primary unnerving experience?
I couldn't answer that. I mean, the thing that characterizes PTSD is that these guys have a bewildering array of symptoms. They have so many different symptoms that you have to sort of narrow it down and figure out, well, where do we start? Their lives can be completely disrupted. You mentioned alcohol abuse and domestic violence, loss of jobs, even homelessness. That's a kind of a shameful secret this country has. One-third of all homeless men in this country are veterans. And we're now seeing, I can't tell you how many, but we're now seeing returnees from Iraq showing up at homeless shelters.
Steve Robinson, our time grows very short here. What's the message we need to take away from this, to be supportive of the troops? What's needed?
Well, the previous caller touched on it. Right now, the soldiers get a form when they get out of Iraq or Afghanistan, and they fill out that form, and it may or may not be reviewed by a competent medical authority. And if they do indicate that they have a problem, they may or may not get a referral. So the military is the one that sends these people to war, and we have to then be the one to take care of them when they come home. The answer is we need to press Congress to force the military to take the burden of caring for the war wounded, whether they be amputee or PTSD or whatever problem they come back with, but more aggressive outreach when people come home. You can't necessarily bring them back and throw them right into therapy, but what you can do, one of the things I'm advocating is at least one clinical encounter before they're discharged over to the VA with someone that is a trained psychologist, psychiatrist. They can look at them, evaluate them, and then give them the information they need if this becomes a problem down the road.
So at least that. Stephen Robinson is author of Hidden Toll of the War in Iraq, Mental Health in the Military. You can read that report at our website, onpointradio.org. Stephen Robinson, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Dr. Evan Kander, we wish you good luck with your work there. We thank you for doing it, and we thank you for being with us this evening.
Thank you, Tom.
Dr. Evan Kander, staff psychiatrist at the Puget Sound Veterans Hospital. He joined us from Seattle. Jack Beatty, there's a picture, and we heard it from the soldiers themselves, and you could hear the emotion in their voices. This is always tough.
It is, and, the veterans, the Department of Veterans Affairs, according to them, the number of Vietnam veterans who are homeless today exceeds the number of their comrades who were killed in the war.
That's something to ponder. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
In a moment, a poem honoring the men and women serving far from home at Christmas time. This is On Point. Across the globe, hundreds of thousands of American servicemen and women will be spending Christmas far from family and friends. No hearth and home, just danger and the loneliness of being apart from loved ones at the holidays. In 1987, Marine Corporal James Schmidt wrote a poem to honor those serving far from home at Christmas. He built it on "'Twas the Night Before Christmas" and called it "'Merry Christmas, My Friend." The poem took on a life of its own. It was published in a military magazine. Soldiers Xeroxed it and mailed it to friends. Nearly 20 years later, it is still being shared across the internet and on military blogs. Tonight, the poem's original author, James Schmidt, shares his best wishes for soldiers overseas and reads his poem, A Christmas Eve Tale Told by Santa, as he drops in on a U.S. Marine in a far-off land.
My thoughts this Christmas, of course, are with our troops, men and women of all the armed forces that are serving overseas, not just in Afghanistan and Iraq, but around the world. And I'd hope that we just stop and take a moment as Christmas approaches and we take stock of our lives and what these young men and women are doing halfway across the world for us and realize that they don't have to be there. They volunteered for it. And tonight, tomorrow night, as Christmas Eve approaches, they're in harm's way. And we should stop for just a minute while we open our presents and remember what's really important in life, and that is our loved ones who may very well be far away in harm's way at this time. Here is the first public greeting of the poem I authored back in 1987 entitled Merry Christmas, My Friend. 'Twas the night before Christmas. He lived all alone in a one-bedroom house made of plaster and stone. I had come down the chimney with presents to give and to see just who in this home did live. But as I looked about, a strange sight I did see. No tinsel, no presents, not even a tree. No stocking by the fire, just boots filled with sand. And on the wall hung pictures of a far distant land with medals and badges, awards of all kind. A sobering thought soon came to my mind, for this house was different, unlike any I'd seen. This was the home of a U.S. Marine. I'd heard stories about them. I had to see more. So I walked down the hall and I pushed open the door. And there he lay sleeping, silent, alone, curled up on the floor of his one-bedroom home. He seemed so gentle, his face so serene. Not how I pictured a U.S. Marine. Was this the hero of whom I just read, curled up in his poncho, a floor for his bed? His head was clean-shaven, his weathered face tan. I soon understood this was more than a man, for I realized the families that I saw that night owed their lives to these men who were willing to fight. Soon around the nation, the children would play and grown-ups would celebrate on a bright Christmas day. They all enjoyed freedom each month and all year, because of Marines, like this one lying here. I couldn't help wonder how many lay alone on a cold Christmas Eve in a land far from home. Just the very thought brought a tear to my eye. I dropped to my knees and I started to cry. But he must have awoke, for I heard a rough voice. Santa, don't cry. This life is my choice. I fight for freedom. I don't ask for more. My life is my God, my country, my core. With that, he rolled over, drifted off into sleep. I couldn't control it. I continued to weep. I watched him for hours, so silent and still, and I noticed he shivered from the cold night's chill. So I took off my jacket, the one made of red, and covered this Marine from his toes to his head. Then I put on his T-shirt of scarlet and gold, with an eagle, globe, and anchor emblazoned so bold. And although it barely fit me, I began to swell with pride. And for one shining moment, I was Marine Corps deep inside. I didn't want to leave him so quiet in the night, this guardian of honor so willing to fight. But half asleep, he rolled over, and in a voice clean and pure, said, "Carry on, Santa. It's Christmas Day, all secure." One look at my watch, and I knew he was right. Merry Christmas, my friend. Semper Fi, and good night.
James Schmidt is a former Marine Corps corporal. He wrote the poem Merry Christmas, My Friend in 1987. To read the text of the poem, go to our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.